Burlington, Vermont. Winter has come later this season, as it has every year since the end of the war. Snow blankets the house and surrounding farmland and frosts the trees that shade the dirt track by the river. Everything about this scene is peaceful, except for the man with me. He insists on calling himself the Wacko. Because everyone else calls me that, why shouldn't you? His stride is fast and purposeful. The cane given to him by his doctor and wife serves only to stab at the air. To be honest, I wasn't surprised to be nominated for vice president. Everyone knew a coalition party was inevitable. I'd been a rising star, at least until I self-destructed. That's what they said about me, right? All the cowards and hypocrites who'd rather die than see a real man express his passion. So what if I wasn't the world's best politician? I said what I felt, and I wasn't afraid to say it loud and clear. That's one of the main reasons I was the logical choice for co-pilot. We made a great team. He was the light, I was the heat. Different parties, different personalities. And let's not kid ourselves, different skin colors as well. I knew I wasn't the first choice. I know who my party secretly wanted, but America wasn't ready to go that far, as stupid, ignorant, and infuriatingly Neolithic as it sounds. They'd rather have a screaming radical for a VP than another one of those people. So I wasn't surprised at my nomination. I was surprised at everything else.
You mean the elections?
Elections. Honolulu was still a madhouse. Soldiers, congressmen, refugees, all bumping into one another trying to find something to eat, or a place to sleep, or just to find out what the hell was going on. And that was paradise next to the mainland. The Rocky Line was just being established. Everything west of it was a war zone. Why go through all the trouble of elections when you could have Congress simply vote for extended emergency powers? The Attorney General had tried it when he was mayor of New York. Almost got away with it, too. I explained to the president that we didn't have the energy or resources to do anything but fight for our very existence.
What did he say?
Well, let's just say he convinced me otherwise.
Can you elaborate?
I could. But I don't want to mangle his words. The old neurons aren't firing like they used to.
Please try.
You'll fact-check with his library?
I promise.
Well, we were in his temporary office, the presidential suite of a hotel. He'd just been sworn in on Air Force Two. His old boss was sedated in the suite next to us. From the window, you could see the chaos on the streets. The ships at sea lining up to dock, the planes coming in every 30 seconds, and ground crew pushing them off the runway once they landed to make room for new ones. I was pointing to them, shouting and gesturing with the passion I'm most famous for. "We need a stable government, fast," I kept saying. "Elections are great in principle, but this is no time for high ideals." The president was cool. A lot cooler than me. Maybe it was all that military training. He said to me, "This is the only time for high ideals because those ideals are all that we have. We aren't just fighting for our physical survival, but for the survival of our civilization. We don't have the luxury of old world pillars. We don't have a common heritage. We don't have a millennia of history. All we have are the dreams and promises that bind us together. All we have,
struggling to remember,
all we have is what we want to be." You see what he was saying. Our country only exists because people believed in it. And if it wasn't strong enough to protect us from this crisis, then what future could it ever hope to have? He knew that America wanted a Caesar, but to be one would mean the end of America. They say great times make great men. I don't buy it. I saw a lot of weakness, a lot of filth. People who should have risen to the challenge and either couldn't or wouldn't. Greed, fear, stupidity, and hate. I saw it before the war. I see it today. My boss was a great man. We were damn lucky to have him. The business of elections really set the tone for his entire administration. So many of his proposals looked crazy at first glance, but once you peeled back the first layer, you realized that underneath there existed a core of irrefutable logic. Take the new punishment laws. Those really set me off. Putting people in stocks? Whipping them in town squares? What was this, old Salem? The Taliban's Afghanistan? It sounded barbaric, un-American, until you really thought about the options. What were you going to do with thieves and looters? Put them in prison? Who would that help? Who could afford to divert able-bodied citizens to feed, clothe, and guard other able-bodied citizens? More importantly, why remove the punished from society when they could serve as such a valuable deterrent? Yes, there was the fear of pain, the lash, the cane, but all of that paled when compared to public humiliation. People were terrified of having their crimes exposed. At a time when everyone was pulling together, helping each other out, working to protect and take care of one another, the worst thing you could do to someone was to march them up into the public square with a giant poster reading, "I stole my neighbor's firewood." Shame's a powerful weapon, but it depended on everyone else doing the right thing. No one is above the law, and seeing a senator given 15 lashes for his involvement in war profiteering did more to curb crime than a cop on every street corner. Yes, there were the work gangs, but those were the recidivists, those who'd been given chances time and time again. I remember the Attorney General suggesting that we dump as many of them into the infested zones as possible, rid ourselves of the drain and potential hazard of their continued presence. Both the President and I opposed this proposition. My objections were ethical, his were practical. We were still talking about American soil. Infested, yes, but hopefully one day to be liberated. The last thing we need, he said, was to come up against one of these ex-cons as the new Grand Warlord of Duluth. I thought he was joking, but later, as I saw the exact thing happen in other countries, as some exiled criminals rose to command their own isolated, and in some cases powerful, fiefdoms, I realized we'd dodged one hell of a speeding bullet. The work gangs were always an issue for us, politically, socially, even economically. But what other choice did we have for those who just refused to play nice with others? You did use the death penalty. Only in extreme cases. Sedition, sabotage, attempted political secession. Zombies weren't the only enemies, at least not in the beginning. We had our share of religious fundamentalists. What country didn't? Many of them believed that we were in some way interfering with God's will. He chuckles. I'm sorry. I've got to learn to be more sensitive. But for crying out loud, you really think the supreme creator of the infinite multiverse is going to have his plans unraveled by a few Arizona National Guardsmen? He waves the thought away. They got a lot more press than they should have, all because that nutbird tried to kill the president. In reality, they were much more a danger to themselves, all those mass suicides, the Mercy child killings in Medford. Terrible business. Same with the Greenies, the lefty version of the Fundies. They believed that since the living dead only consumed animals but not plants, it was the will of the divine goddess to favor flora over fauna. They made a little trouble, dumping herbicide in a town's water supply, booby-trapping trees so loggers couldn't use them for war production. That kind of eco-terrorism eats up headlines, but didn't really threaten our national security. The Rebs, on the other hand, armed, organized political secessionists, that was easily our most tangible danger. It was also the only time I ever saw the president worried. He wouldn't let on, not with that dignified diplomatic veneer. In public, he treated it as just another issue, like food rationing or road repair. He'd say in private, they must be eliminated swiftly, decisively, and by any means necessary. Of course, he was only talking about those within the Western safe zone. These die-hard renegades either had some beef with the government's wartime policy or had already planned to secede years before and were just using the crisis as their excuse. These were the enemies of our country, the domestic ones anyone swearing to defend our country mentions in his or her oath. We didn't have to think twice about an appropriate response to them, but the secessionists east of the Rockies, in some of the besieged, isolated zones, that's when it got complicated.
Why is that?
Because, as the saying went, we didn't leave America. America left us. There's a lot of truth to that. We deserted those people. Yes, we left some Special Forces volunteers, tried to supply them by sea and air, but from a purely moral standing, these people were truly abandoned. I couldn't blame them for wanting to go their own way. Nobody could. That's why, when we began to reclaim lost territory, we allowed every secessionist enclave a chance for peaceful reintegration.
But there was violence.
I still have nightmares. Places like Bolivar and the Black Hills. I never see the actual images, not the violence or the aftermath. I always see my boss, this towering, powerful, vital man, getting sicker and weaker each time. He'd survived so much, shouldered such a crushing burden. You know, he never tried to find out what had happened to his relatives in Jamaica. Never even asked. He was so fiercely focused on the fate of our nation, so determined to preserve the dream that created it. I don't know if great times make great men, but I know they can kill them.